Hi, and welcome to The Playlist, where we talk about good TV, great movies, and where you can watch them, with special attention to the best things you can find at SBS On Demand. I'm your host, Fiona Williams. I'm managing editor of SBS Movies, and I'm joined by my co-host and SBS TV Guide editor, Nick Bassine.
How's it going?
Good, thanks.
So today we've got an unbelievable, just unbelievable show. We're going to be talking about stand-up comedy and how it's everywhere at the moment. We're also going to be talking to the director Mick Jackson, who's directed movies like LA Story and The Bodyguard. We're going to be talking to him about his new movie, Denial, which is in theaters this week. But first, stand-up comedy. Netflix has a bunch of new specials from Dave Chappelle, Louis C.K., and Stan is pushing out a whole bunch of specials from Australian comics. There's a new show about the LA comedy scene in the 70s that Jim Carrey produced. Stand-up comedy seems super hot.
You might say, what is the deal with all of the comedy? Or well, you might not.
No, I mean, I think you just did.
I know. I'm not sure I should have. Netflix is big on the stand-up comedy specials, aren't they? There's always a new one popping up to the recommendations. Why is that?
Ted Sarandis of Netflix said that people like to watch movies in between binging series, but producer Dan, our producer, has a theory that people like to watch comedy specials in between, stand-up comedy specials.
Well, that could account for why there are so many popping up on the platform. Yeah, I mean, maybe when you've finished binging Narcos or House of Cards or something, you might feel like a bit of a stand-up special watching a bit of Louis C.K. or Dave Chappelle. That would obviously account for why they're investing in it so heavily. Big money in it too for the comedians. Dave Chappelle obviously has been out of public eye for a decade, is it now? And he's been paid $60 million for 3 Netflix specials.
Yes. He turned down $50 million to continue his show when he quit.
Yeah.
I watched the specials, The Age of Spin. It's so complicated because I am an enormous fan of that show. I think, like a lot of people, I think it's an amazing, amazing show. And it's still funny. It holds up and in a way that a lot of those kinds of sketch shows wouldn't. The characters he created, I just run out of ways of saying how much I love that stuff.
Yeah, this is a Chappelle show from back in the day. I think SBS had it, actually.
Yeah, it was on NITV for a little while, too.
Mm. Famously walked away mid the last season, didn't? Well, it was the last because he walked away, but it was unfinished.
They offered him a bunch of money and to keep going, and he walked away for legitimate reasons. I mean, he had his own stuff he was going through, and he was uncomfortable with certain white reactions to his satire of black life and black characters, and so it's totally legitimate. I've always maintained that he's funny on that show. That show is funny. His stand-up is not that funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have to couch everything that we talk about. All of these people are geniuses. They're all wonderful, and it's great, and it's stand-up comedy is incredibly hard, and I appreciate it. But this doesn't make me laugh. I didn't have that much fun.
Yeah, I'm the same. I enjoy comedy. I go to occasional stand-up shows, but yeah, I'm not a laugh-out-loud kind of person for it. I had a wry observation of life.
Yeah, maybe.
Or a really cutting political joke. Joke. What was that?
Joke.
Joke.
yeah, I hear you.
Or a really cutting political joke.
Yeah. I like the way you pronounced it the first time.
That was in case of edits.
But I love to laugh out loud. I want to laugh out loud. Mm. I don't trust people that don't laugh.
Mm.
If you don't laugh, you're dead inside. I think Jesus said that.
It's in the Bible up there.
So I'm going in there. Come on, let's go. I'm excited. And I found Chappelle's, and there's been a lot that's been written about it already. But it just feels old.
So there are 2 specials up at the moment. The first one is The Age of Spin. And aside from being the return of Dave Chappelle, it also features a couple of jokes that have made some headlines for the wrong reasons.
Sure.
There's a reference to trans people that is a little off colour.
Not that he needs to be on board with the way society is shifting. If he was resisting this kind of thing, and I don't know, maybe there's a joke in there somewhere, except it comes at the expense of a small marginalized community.
That's the real thing. I mean, it's not impossible to make a joke that features a trans person in it.
Yeah.
But the joke shouldn't be on the trans person.
It's the classic punching up thing where he's clearly
punching down.
He's punching down. He's a black man, and that's part of his point. He's not punching down. He's because he's a black man. He's punching sideways.
Across, yeah.
I guess. Whether that is valid or not, I guess is the sideways punch. I don't know. But punching up is generally the direction people like to go in.
Mm-hmm.
It just felt very old, kind of old,
that's
old-fashioned,
yeah.
And old and tired a little bit. And like, is that an interesting perspective that he's got on like trans people take it easy with all your rights and what have you? I don't know.
Well, in the it'll take a minute kind of the way he makes the gag. I mean, you understand the broader context and it's framed that way, but the joke itself doesn't work and it comes across as old. And that's the issue. I mean, he's been away for 10 years not doing comedy and he's come back. People expect him to be woke and to be in touch with the times, but on that particular gag it's not. It doesn't work in the room.
Now I feel I didn't watch the Texas one. But based on the age of Spin, it makes it feel, not that he's just out of touch, but also it just makes me feel like things are different now and you can't rely on that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And that's the thing with his humor, because when it's best, you know, it does take this surreal kind of turn and he manages to go off on a tangent, have a gag and then come back and it lands with quite a bit of a sting to it. And that's where you kind of going with it and waiting for this thing to come, and it just doesn't, it's just a bad gag.
I mean,
that's what's disappointing out about it. It's sort of, okay, I'm going to allow you some rope here, but then it just doesn't land.
And just for the, I mean, he's got rape jokes and all kinds of stuff in there, and I totally support going after all of that stuff. He's on there to be provocative and challenge people. And I mean, ultimately, yeah, I wasn't laughing.
In theory, I don't think anything's off limits. It's who's the joke on? And, you know, I don't mind a shocking joke or a provocative joke. Yeah, it's just who's the object of the laugh in that. And I guess as a flip side, there's Louis C.K. has a special as well, come out to Netflix. Coincidentally, he also has a trans joke in his special. The main difference is with Louis, the joke's on him.
Yes.
In his particular joke that features a trans person. It's about a object of his affection from childhood.
Well, the way I thought of their two different acts is Louis seems to be acknowledging how complicated all of these issues are, and his jokes are about that complexity.
And navigating.
Yeah, navigating them, acknowledging that both sides there's some validity on both sides, and then we supposedly laugh at the discomfort of how we're stuck in the middle of this and what should we do? What's right? What's wrong? And whereas Chappelle, he's got a very firm stance. He's coming down on one side and making a joke in support of that one side.
Mm.
And I think with these kinds of issues now in 2017, the better place to be is coming from the middle, I think.
Mm.
But also with Louis, I laughed at the one bit, the diseased, sick dog that he got.
Because, rescue dog.
Because it's politically correct to get a rescue dog.
Yeah.
And when he's talking about how he's got two kids, so his circle of caring about people has shrunken and he doesn't care about anybody or anything anymore, except for his two kids. I related to that. And I thought that was pretty funny. But otherwise, I think he's a really smart, perceptive guy, but an artist. And his show is great for two or three seasons. And But I wasn't slapping my knees. Normally I slap my knees.
You do it a lot, I've noticed. Back to Chappelle as well. I mean, he does the I'm a gentrified black man jokes quite well. I mean, there was the good one he talks about being pulled over for a traffic stop where he still has a moment of, oh, where's this going? But then he's like, I'm okay, I'm Dave Chappelle. It's the other guy that's gotta worry about it. So he does that element of the observations of his world as a celebrity, but also as a black man. He's far more, there are funnier observations that come out of that, I think, rather than when he veers away from that.
But I will always say he did it better on the show.
Sure.
When he had a lot of writers, and there was a sketch where he did that same joke where he's a celebrity going in to help some diseased kid, I think with a terminal illness, and he plays him in PlayStation, and he beats the kid, and he says, "You think I never played PlayStation before? I'm rich." And that stuff was always funny and still is funny, and what he's doing, the new stuff, is not working for me. Sorry, it's not working for me.
Sorry, Dave. So, shifting gears a little bit, coming to cinemas this week is a story that is alarmingly relevant today. It's about an American historian whose libel trial in the 90s impacted the way that the history of the Holocaust is told today. In 1993, Deborah Lipstadt published a book called Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory, in which she called controversial author and World War II writer David Irving a Holocaust denier. He sued her for libel, and under the peculiarities of the British legal system, her defence team had to prove that the Holocaust actually occurred in order to win her the case. It's directed by Mick Jackson, whose credits include LA Story with Steve Martin and The Bodyguard with Whitney Houston and Kevin Costner.
Always makes me cry.
I'll always love it. Director Mick Jackson joins us on the line now. Thank you so much for your time. The movie is timely in the worst way.
Yeah, it was never meant to be that. I mean, obviously, the producers picked up this story, David Irving, the alt-right historian, like about 8 years ago, mm-hmm. and thought there was a great story there in his fight against a lone woman. And so it was timely at that time because already people were talking about birtherism and climate change and evolution and all kinds of things and denying them. But it sort of crept up on us because it's taken that long to get a decent script in place and to get the movie in place and to make the movie. And I think it was in October of 2015 that I was having dinner with the real Deborah Lipstadt, and we both came to the conclusion at the same time. This was very early on in the presidential campaign. This is Donald Trump. This man that we're portraying, David Irving, is everything. He's doing everything that Trump is doing. He's portraying himself as a patriot, as a man of the people, a truth-sayer, appealing to everybody's basest fears and prejudices. He's saying he's just telling the truth. He's a pricker of hypocrisy and all those things, and playing to a very receptive audience and with the ability as a speaker to really hold an audience in the palm of his hand and to move them to acts of emotion, heights of emotion and passion. So we realized that we had a really kind of timely story here about somebody who was populist, nationalist, alt-right, xenophobic, misogynistic, and all the things that one might uncharitably use as adjectives to describe Donald Trump. We never for a moment thought that he would actually get to the presidency, but we thought the fact that it's about truth and lies, and one of the things that Trump does and David Irving did is throw out things knowing them to be false and just repeating them over and over again until they get accepted by a large number of people as being the truth. So that's the reason why the movie came out last year. The American distributors thought this is so timely and so relevant that we'll actually platform the movie when it opens in the States and do each increase in the number of theatres around the presidential debates, because people will be talking about this issue.
So,
it's an unusual time to open a movie, but they thought that was a gamble they wanted to take.
And now that obviously things have happened and things have moved on, do you feel like it's more resonant now?
Oh yes, I do. I mean, there is. It all comes, really, and we found this early on in our research. There's a concept that Adolf Hitler invented in 1925, writing Mein Kampf. This is not to make any kind of comparisons between present-day figures and Hitler, but it's interesting that he came up with this concept that he called Der große Lüge, the big lie, which is basically an idea that's so wacky and out there and outrageous that nobody would have the balls to invent it. And then when he came to power, Joseph Goebbels, who was his Minister of Information, put the final spin on it. And he says, yeah, when you're lying, lie big and stick to it. Repeat, 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 repeat. And he might have been talking about a cable news echo chamber in saying that. You just say something that's outrageously wrong and is so big and so gross, like a million people were fraudulent votes or whatever, or the theory of evolution is a hoax or whatever. And the more you say it, the more it becomes, you just, the outrage goes, and you start to accept it as a fact of life. So that's very, very relevant. And, you know, it's not just the lying, but it's the political situation throughout the world, particularly in Europe, in Germany and Holland and France, the extreme right-wing, and in Britain, of course, with the Brexit, the extreme right-wing views are coming to the forefront, including, you know, being xenophobic and anti-immigrants and a willingness to blame the other. Now, in Irving's case, it was a huge lie that the Holocaust had never happened. And, you know, the blaming the Jews for practically everything. But it's not just the Jews. Now, anti-Semitism is, to some extent, less prevalent, well, less to the top of the list than anti-Muslim, anti-Mexican, anti-Black, all those prejudices that come to power. The other, in other words, the people who, if you're a demagogue like David Irving or like Donald Trump, you can blame for all the fact that you are one of the losers in society, that you don't have the standard of living anymore that you had, or the security, and the world is passing you by. So that's rather a big mouthful, I'm sorry.
No,
it's all right. Yeah, no, absolutely.
It was a simple question.
I was watching the movie, I knew, you know, obviously know what happens at the end and how it turns out, but the way things have been going around the world, there was a moment where I thought, this guy might pull it off.
Yeah, if the trial was now. You know, and of course...
Well, I think there was a moment at the end of the real trial where, you know, it seemed that they had got him on the run, and yeah, that it was like game, set, and match. And then the judge, with that kind of unpredictable Englishness, intervened and asked this loony question about supposing he believes it.
Exactly.
Not telling a lie if you believe it.
It was so strange that
where they thought then suddenly that they might lose. And that would have been disastrous because... As you know, and as I think we explain in the film, the burden of proof is on her.
Yes.
There's no freedom of First Amendment freedom of speech in, or there wasn't then in British libel law. If you accuse somebody, they could say to you, well, prove it. Prove what you said about me is true. Mm. Rather than them having the right to say something, and then you have to prove that it's not true. So if you think about that for a second, he said the Holocaust is a myth, it's a hoax, it didn't happen. And someone says, you're a Holocaust denier, your get out of jail free clause is that, well, if there was no Holocaust, then I wasn't denying it because there was nothing to deny. So she is forced effectively to prove that the Holocaust did happen.
Right.
And therefore she was right to call him a Holocaust denier. It sounds rather complicated. But that put the onus very much on her. And I think that's maybe the human drama of the movie, that she is a kind of a very kind of personality-driven person. Well, she's a lively personality, but essentially she's an academic in a provincial university in America, and she suddenly finds herself on the world stage in a very unfamiliar climate of opinion and assumptions, and literally rains all the time. On the world stage against somebody who is, you know, a masterly manipulator of speech, and a person who ducks and weaves and you can't really nail down. So it's a tremendous challenge. So I think that there is... Oh, sorry.
No, you're okay.
Stop me.
No,
please.
Not at all. I'm happy to let you.
I'm rambling on.
I was
going to say that there is a tradition, that one of the difficulties that David Hare and I had with making this movie is that there's a tradition of movies like, for example, Erin Brockovich or Mr. Smith Goes to Washington or whatever, where you start with a humble person, humble-ish anyway, who doesn't have a natural speaking ability, is not a kind of a known figure, they're just a face in the crowd, and something happens, like in Erin Brockovich, where they're pulled into events that they're not prepared for. And they don't have a voice, but... You know, they do have a kind of belief in themselves or whatever, and through the course of the film, they achieve a voice. They become someone, and there's this magnificent speech that all of them have in the third act where they stand up and they make this amazing speech and everybody claps and applauds. Well, this is the opposite. This was a woman who was very feisty and had a voice to start with. She's very articulate. She's very opinionated. She's very secure in what she knows and not afraid to say it. She doesn't suffer fools gladly. And the opposite happens to her than happens in Erin Brockovich. People say, well, we don't want, well, that's fine, but we don't want you to use any of that. We want you to be silent in court. Because if you do what you want to do, what your passion is telling you you must do, which is stand up and say, this is a lie, you are a liar, and all of that, you will make the case about you, or he will make it about you, and not about what he said. So you must be quiet.
Yeah.
And more so, you can't either bring Holocaust survivors into court to testify about what they saw. That makes it about them, and he has a history of humiliating in other trials, humiliating Holocaust survivors by pinning them down and saying, well, when you got off the train, did you turn left or right? And they say, I don't remember. Well, were they in grey uniforms or blue uniforms? And you know, that's trivial detail, but you make it about the whole thing. And you know, he has reduced Holocaust survivors in the past to tears. We don't want it to be about that. We have to behave as if we know the Holocaust happened, and to make the trial about what he wrote.
Sure. And in the treatment of David Irving, how did you? I mean, obviously, you have to include his views, but how did you determine how much screen time to give to him? I mean, I notice you don't include his closing argument in the film or things like that. So how did you sort of work out the balance of how much you wanted him to say in the film?
Well, there's a caption at the beginning of the film which says, I don't know if it's in the Australian and New Zealand version that you're seeing, this is based on a true story.
Mm. Yes.
That bothered me and bothered David Hare, the screenwriter, because we think you should say, this is a true story.
Yeah.
Right.
We have based everything that was said in court exactly word for word on the transcript of the court trial. Everything that the David Irving character, played by Tim Spall, says in the movie, he said, either in court or in an article he wrote or in speeches or in his books or in addresses to crowds, every single word is verbatim that he says. So we didn't go to him. We didn't think he would be a willing collaborator on the movie. Mm. And we didn't, you know, want to change the fact that this is told from Deborah Lipstadt's point of view. But we did want him not to have the opportunity to say, well, you've distorted what I said. And so we went to great pains to, you know, make what he said in the movie. And I think the two sides have an equal argument there. We don't show him or try and psychoanalyze him in his private life. There's only one scene where you see him with his small infant child. Mm. But we don't go into that. We just let his words speak for themselves.
Sure. And I understand the Auschwitz portions of the film, you did actually film there. That's correct?
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
Because that was what happened in real life, in the real trial, as they came up for trial just before 2000. The legal team went because, as the real Richard Rampton said, this is a murder trial and you've got to go to the scene of the crime, as you would with any murder case. And so they went and they walked over the site to see how easy or difficult it would be to prove what had happened there if they had to. And when the original people went, it was in a much different time. Back in those days, it was only, it was within many people's living memory, the World War II, and the people who ran Auschwitz then said, come in, see it. We want you to see this, to see what was done here. In the intervening time, two things happened. It became a shrine for obvious reasons, and therefore you had to treat it very carefully. But the weather, particularly in the ruins of the gas chamber, has not been kind to it. It's kind of Central European weather, so it's very, very freezing in the winters, and rain and snow and so on. Everything is very delicately kind of decaying. And even when we were there doing our scouting, people were going in at night and trying to prop up the ruins. So there's no question of us actually walking on the roof of the gas chamber. So that required very delicate negotiations with the people at Auschwitz. It spent us, took us years, literally, of talking to them and reasoning with them to say, look, this is important, this is history, this is part of your history. If you can't let us do this, at least can you make it look as if the actors are actually walking on the roof of the gas chamber?
Mm.
So that was a kind of bit of movie magic there. They did let us take actors to Auschwitz. We could film in certain areas, mostly outside the perimeter fence, but it meant that you could have the buildings in the background, and then buildings that looked as if they were inside the perimeter fence that we could film in. And then we had to build a set in the outskirts of London, the actual ruins of the gas chamber roof itself, and merge that into shots that we took at Auschwitz.
Right.
Okay. Excuse me for the interruption there, Fiona. We've got a two-minute wrap-up.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm rabbiting too much.
No, not at all. It's all great.
So since we only have a couple more minutes, we're a TV and movies podcast. So, and at the end of every interview, I like to ask our guest what they've been watching, movies, a movie, a TV show, anything they've been loving or hating.
Well, I love Moonlight, and I voted for that in the Oscars. Most recently, I saw Trainspotting 2.
Oh, yeah.
What did you think of that?
Oh, well, it's not easy viewing. I don't know if it's a date movie. I went with my wife, but it's exhilarating and bravura movie making. I was laughing at the audacity of it. I thought it was wonderful. And Tony Erdmann, a German movie.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Did that get your foreign language vote?
I thought... moved me, so I was crying, and was so funny I actually had tears running down my face because I couldn't stop laughing. I thought it was the most amazing film. I know it was entered for the best foreign movie, but I think it could have been up there with the contenders for best movie.
Did you have really an emotional reaction movie to the Moonlight versus La La Land situation?
I did. I know everybody else was voting for La La Land, and I think the timing was unfortunate for them.
Yeah.
I voted for Moonlight. I had realized everybody else was going to vote for La La Land and it was probably going to win. And I thought, well, hang on. In this moment in our history, you know, Trump has just been elected and there are certain kind of very right-wing and authoritarian tendencies happening here. Do you really want to be seen to be remaking Gold Diggers of 1933 and forget that was the year Hitler came to power in Germany?
Right.
So I felt it was kind of out of tone with the times. A beautiful film and wonderfully made.
Sure.
But out of tune with the mood of the times, and Moonlight very much within that mood.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you very much. Meg, appreciate your time.
No, truly, thank you. It's been a real treat.
Not at all. It's been a great pleasure.
So that was Mick Jackson.
I really wish we had asked him about The Bodyguard.
Well, tip for us in our interviews to really work on the time there. We got wrapped up, but had some Bodyguard LA Story questions too. But
well, we'll just have to save those questions for whoever's next.
Yeah. Denial opens around Australia on April 13. So where do you go from a story about a Holocaust-denying Hitler apologist other than to the definitive biopic of Hitler? We've got Downfall coming to SBS this month as part of a war movie season of films on air on SBS on Friday night, final Friday in April.
It's an amazing movie.
It's great, isn't it? Yeah, I just recently rewatched it.
Me too.
So this, of course, Bruno Ganz plays Adolf Hitler in the final few days of the Third Reich. And it's kind of an observational dramatization of what life was like down in the bunker as Hitler's private secretary was exchanging worried glances with all of the key players of the Third Reich as Russia was advancing above ground, and she's carrying with her colleagues down in the bunker as Hitler's erupting into paranoid rants every time he gets bad news.
It's pretty harrowing and tense all the way through.
And it's glum and it's weird, but it's not sympathetic. I mean, you're not feeling bad that it's all coming to an end. I think the tone is right. I think Bruno Ganz is great.
Yeah.
It does have that balance of it's observant. It's not fascinating in that you're getting new insights into him. It's not an unexpected story of how it's all falling apart.
There's no denouement where he's or there's no rosebud moment where you realize, oh, it was all because he wasn't loved as a child or anything like that. But what he does just being a dictator at the end of his run, it's mesmerizing.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I do enjoy it very much.
I mean, and all that head shaking, I couldn't keep my eyes off of it. I was entranced.
The head shaking and the spit, the full bodied performance. I mean, even with the hand, the tremor.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's it's all really calculated.
I went back and watched some real Hitler footage. I don't know if he shook his head that much.
In the speeches, you see the...
Sure. I'm saying some of that's Gans, though, is what I'm saying.
Oh, I'm sure. It's still an actor as well. Anyway.
What? Yeah, all right, go ahead.
Yeah, all right. But, of course, Downfall found a second life as a subject of memes.
Yeah.
Doing the rounds of the internet. And rewatching, I went, oh, here it comes. That scene.
Yeah.
Where everyone's in the room. There's a lot of stolen glances across the room. Oh, God, who's going off on a tear now? Who's going to be the one to deliver the bad news? Here it comes. The much-memed moment has paired off a little bit in recent years. I don't think there's as many Downfall memes anymore.
No.
Yeah,
I think. My God, it's been 13 years. I haven't seen one in a while.
Yeah, so there
you would hope that people have moved on.
You would think. I enjoy a good Downfall meme when I used to see them. They could have any ridiculous little things. So it didn't matter what the subject was. It was very of its time. So if you went back now and looked at something that you laughed at back in, 2010, it probably wouldn't have quite the same resonance. There are some great moments in there that always make for quite a funny gag.
Do you? Is there a particular one that you think of when you think of the memes?
Not really. I mean, I remember there was one about something Qantas did that was really stupid. See, again, now,
yeah,
that's a vague memory, but it's always how they subtitle the exact moments that get a laugh. But, and I mean, there's a meme about the memes. There's one where Hitler finds out he's the subject of the memes, which is kind of the classic one. SBS, we've even done one about doing a Downfall meme with the subtitling department.
We have?
Yes.
I was aware of the memes when I rewatched it, and I was still in... well, not that the movie is now an internet joke, but it's...
No.
It's still resonated as powerfully for me.
Exactly. Yeah, you can appreciate the movie as a definitive biopic of Hitler, and also be aware of its place in pop culture history as the subject of stupid memes.
Yes.
Yes. So, yes, as I said, Downfall screening on SBS at the end of the month as part of the war movie season, with catch up at SBS On Demand afterwards.
So, as always, we'd like to wrap up an episode with what you've been watching. Mick, you might remember from earlier on in the episode.
Yeah.
He's been watching Moonlight.
Yeah.
He was glad it won.
Mm. Weren't we all?
Those Oscars. And... Now, what have you been watching?
Well, I have been watching New York, New York. I put on the old...
The Liza Minnelli movie.
Indeed. Martin Scorsese, friend of the show.
Friend of the pod.
Yes, Marty to me, but anyway. Yes, the old Liza Minnelli, Robert De Niro musical.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I put that one on. Not one that always stands up in Marty's resume
canon.
As... Yeah, indeed, the canon. But I really enjoy it. I think it's not a perfect film by any means, but it's a musical set in the jazz age, sort of post-World War II. Robert De Niro is the GI back in New York, very talented saxophone player. Liza is a very talented singer. He tries to woo her. She deflects his advances for quite some time, but of course they get together.
Oh, playing hard to get.
Very much so. She's not buying it. He's working the room to all the ladies and happens upon Liza, but she doesn't want a bar of it. But anyway, yeah, they get together and it's a sort of a musical story of the rise of her rise as a singer / actress and their trajectory, their love story. I really enjoyed it. The way it switches, it starts on his story but then becomes about her and New York, New York. Her version of the song is, of course, the big the big number at the end. I was pleasantly surprised. It doesn't always get praised because it's a bit meandering. It was apparently a 4-hour cut that's been cut down. So there's a few shortcuts made in the way their love story evolves. But you fill in the gaps.
I'm sure I've seen it. It sounds pretty familiar. But I don't remember anything about it. Does Robert De Niro have a mustache?
No, sort of that. 5 o'clock so shadow.
Not even remembering that correctly. Is it set in New York?
What gave that away? Yes. Oldie but a goldie. What about you? What have you been watching?
Well, Foxtel recently ran a big Batman and Superman stunt where they threw up all
pop-up
the
Batman or something.
Yeah, all the Batman movies, all the Superman movies, except for the one from the 60s. I noticed they didn't put that one up. The classic shark spray one. Shark repellent. So I watched it with my son. He's 6. Watched it straight through. I didn't allow him to eat or go to the bathroom at any point. Been a real ride. Mm-hmm. We started off with Batman.
Tim Burton.
Yeah, the Tim Burton one. And then Batman Returns. Those two were great. It was great watching those again. We switched gears a little bit to Batman Forever and Batman and Robin, which were super terrible.
A few blips in there.
Like as bad as now people look back on those.
I'm sorry. That's Joel Schumacher on the line.
Some people look back on those old Star Wars prequels, like, oh, they weren't so bad as you thought they were. These movies are just as bad as everyone said they were. They are unwatchable.
All right. And what 6-year-old have to say about them?
He kept looking at me. He kept saying, what's going on with this crazy guy? That was kind of his line throughout the movies. Mm-hmm. But then we get to the Christopher Nolan stuff. And Batman Begins is very good.
Yeah. How did a 6-year-old take to that? They're quite talky, from what I recall. The Batman Begins, anyway.
He likes it. But he was more engaged with the action because it was so intense. And then there's also a lot of the Batman growl is introduced. And so he and I had a lot of fun doing that. And then, of course, the Bane. He had a lot of fun with my Bane impression.
Well, you can't refer to it without doing it.
Do you feel in charge? It's a little bit of Darth Vader in there. It's hard to do without the mask.
This is true. I remember, I've only seen it the once in the movies, but yeah, just turning to my viewing partner and saying, what did he say? Because I cannot actually understand what he's saying.
There's a lot of weird choices in that last one. And but I love Tom Hardy doing that. It's so strange. And he's so crazy. And when he puts his hand on Ben Mendelsohn's shoulder and says, do you feel in charge? I just loved it. Dark Knight's the best one, though. Mm. Better than the first couple? I don't know.
For different reasons, I think. I'm just going to be Switzerland here and say that they each have their own merits.
Yeah,
I do have great affection for the Tim Burton one, the first one. I love Michael Keaton, so
yeah,
I think he was a great Batman. I think it's probably time to wrap this up. We're going to put some notes about the episode online with some recommended links to the shows and the movies that we've been talking about. Please make sure that you subscribe and give us a review wherever you get your podcasts from. And if you have any questions at all, get in touch with us via SBS Movies on Facebook or Twitter. Or send us an email at film@sbs.com.au. I'm Fiona Williams. I'm Fiona Williams, and you can reach me on Twitter at anythingbutfifi.
I'm Nick Bassin. You can reach me on Twitter at @NICKBHASIN.
And our producer is Dan Barrett. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.